my wife was like, I was like, remember I got a podcast? She goes, oh, it's so annoying. Like, can you just do one of those round tables? And I'm like, that was last month.
Hey, everybody. It is episode 209 of Bourbon Pursuit. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny. And the bourbon news cycle, it moves quick. What's trending one day is going to become pretty stale soon. And I'm sure many of you are like myself. When a bourbon warehouse collapses or when 45,000 barrels of bourbon go up in flames from a lightning strike at a Jim Beam warehouse, we probably get a lot of messages in our inbox about it. And I kind of want to focus on this and say, where are we at today on the current situation? So on July 4th, the Woodford County Fire Department waited to extinguish the fire for a few days because, as they said, there is less environmental impact to allowing the ethanol and just letting it continue to burn. Beam Suntory put out a press release saying that the barrels in the warehouse contain relatively young whiskey from the Jim Beam mash bill, and thus it will not impact availability of the product to its customers. And they are going to be working with local, state, and federal agencies to conduct response operations. And now beyond just the whiskey, Jim Beam is looking at a $50 million loss. That would be the bourbon loss at around $45 million, with an estimated additional $5 million in the damages to the warehouses and the cleanup process. And that cleanup is going to be in response to a mass amount of bourbon that has entered the Ohio River after traveling more than 20 miles down the Kentucky River. And the Kentucky's Division of Fish and Wildlife is already characterizing the spill as a severe fish kill, though officials are still continuing to assess the damage to the aquatic life. In a Facebook post on Monday, the Kentucky Energy and Environment Cabinet said that the Department of Fish and Wildlife Resources is on the river again, and they are continuing to assess the fish count kill, and the results are continuing to pend. They are also going to see dead and dying fish. People are using the Kentucky River in the area, and they're going to start seeing and smelling the dead fish as well. Robert Francis, the manager of the emergency response team, said that the bacteria in the water is going after the food source, which is the sugar and the alcohol. So it ends up depleting the oxygen. The fish start to become distressed and they eventually die. According to officials, the dead fish will decompose naturally with no harm to the river, so there is no plan to remove them. Beam Suntory is likely going to be handed a large fine once this comes to a close. If you've taken a drive in Bardstown or Shively, Kentucky, or really anywhere near a distillery or aging warehouses, you'll notice this sort of black fungus or film that grows on the side of rick houses and even finds itself attached to road signs and surrounding homes. In 2007, when University of Toronto mycologist James Scott published an academic paper about the fungus, it pinned it on the whiskey industry. Dr. Scott discovered that this fungus, which he named Bodonia, after the man who first studied it in 1872, Anton Bodone, feeds on the ethanol vapor released by liquor as it ages. Since ethanol is denser than air, the evaporated angel's share doesn't float up into the sky after all, but rather into the surrounding communities. And when this airborne ethanol meets the slightest bit of moisture, it's going to be common because distilleries and towns are usually near those water sources, you get whiskey fungus all over the place. You can read more about this fungus and how it's plaguing neighboring towns from an article on by Vice.com, which can be found in our show notes. This podcast, it's always been about education, and our focus is how do we bring the biggest personalities behind bourbon to the forefront and give listeners a chance and the experience to hear directly from them. We never intended this podcast to be about Ryan or I, and really what we think. And that's why we never did bourbon or whiskey reviews as a part of our format. However, over the years, people are continually asking us what we think of a particular bourbon. So we wanted to figure out a way to do just that without impacting pretty much our scheduled routine here. So next week, we are launching a new content stream that will be available through your current podcast subscription you're listening to right now, as well as YouTube, and we're calling it Whiskey Quickie. As we did with the podcast, we researched the landscape of bourbon reviews on the internet to see which format would be best for us. YouTube, it's a large segment, and the reviews we watched went anywhere from 5 minutes upwards to almost an hour long. So we're setting off to make Whiskey Quickie unlike anything out there today. It's a whiskey review with no cutting and no editing, and it will be done with a 60-second countdown timer. Sure, it may sound rushed, but at first, these reviews are going to give you something else to listen to on Tuesdays while you wait for the usual Thursday podcast release. We're very excited to launch Whiskey Quickie, and the first episode will premiere on July 16th. You can catch Whiskey Quickie right here on your existing podcast subscription, or you can head over to YouTube and watch the video version. All right, I think I've talked enough, so let's get on with the Bourbon Community Roundtable, where we discuss the cultural implications of the Jim Beam fire, as well as Heaven Hill's 7-year Bottled and Bond release. But before that, let's hear Joe from Barrel Bourbon, and then we've got a substitute for Above the Char with Ryan Cecil.
Hi, this is Joe Beatrice from Barrel Craft Spirits. Every batch we produce has a distinct flavor profile. We take pride in blending and preserving spirits for the people who enjoy them the most. You. Use our store locator to find a retailer or bar near you at barrelbourbon.com.
I'm Ryan Cecil. Yep, at that Thrift Joy Loop. Fred's out of town in Portugal doing something really cool. So you have me this week. What I want to talk to you about is being in the whiskey business and all the middlemen and all the hands that are in your pocket. So when Kenny and I started a brand pursuit series, I had no idea how many hands and middlemen would be in our pockets. Anywhere from the ABC people to the distributors to the liquor store owners to the lawyers to the barrel brokers to the label people to the cork people to the glass people to every people in the world that gets their hand in our pocket so we can bring someone some bourbon. But, you know, it's kind of frustrating. But then you think about it. And when I was on the phone with a distributor, his kids got in the car. And I was like, well, wait a minute. This guy has a family he has to pay for. Well, he deserves that. And then you start thinking about the ABC person that's filing your paperwork. And you're like, well, they have a family. I guess they deserve it too. And then you think about the liquor store and the landlord and all the people who just make everything happen. And then I'm like, well, I guess they do deserve it. And so while it is very frustrating and very just greedy of me selfishly, because I am a consumer and a proprietor and creator of a product, that I want to bring the best possible product to my consumers at the best cost. But then, you know, there's a lot of people that we're supporting along the way. And it kind of gives me good perspective about why things are the final price they are as they sit on the bar. And that's this week's Above the Char. Hope I didn't blow it. And we'll see you next time.
Welcome back to another episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. Kenny and Ryan here tonight on the Bourbon Community Roundtable number 34. This is where we talk about all the recent news, things that have been happening inside the bourbon world. And tonight is going to be it's going to be light on topics, but they're going to be very, very heavy topics. So I'm kind of really excited to talk about this one. But before we jump into it, Ryan, what's been new in your world recently?
Sweating a lot. It's hotter than hell.
And the humidity.
It's like, I think it's like our 12th or 13th day in a row, 90 degrees. And it's like, oh, God. But no, it's I'm excited for tonight. We actually, each of us will probably have some room to talk. Like, I'm looking at the tiles in front of me and there's, you know, only 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, where there's normally like 10. So we'll all have our chance to chime in. So I like it.
Yeah, that too. And, you know, you mentioned that it's humidity. I look at it as a good thing because I always like to think that I'm walking and I'm sweating and I'm losing weight. But maybe it's just not that. Maybe it really is just the humidity kicking in there.
And then you drink one of those stouts and you're like right back at it.
It's like I keep gaining weight, but I'm actually sweating too much. I don't think that's how it's supposed to work.
Yeah, it's just like working out or going to the sauna are the same thing. Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. Not quite, but
are you sweating out those demons? Is that what
you're doing? Exactly, for sure.
All right. So as usual, what we're going to do is we're going to go around the horn. So I'm going to go start off my left, our Cal Ripken of the Bourbon Community Roundtable. Blake, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is the, what are we at, 37th roundtable?
Close, 34.
That is incredible.
34 roundtables. Yeah. So congratulations to everyone on that. No, always great to be here. I'm Blake from Bourboner. You can find me on all the interwebs and social medias, BOURBONR.com, as well as sealbox.com as well for all your craft spirit needs. That's SEELBACHS. Thanks for having me.
Spirit shipped right to your door. It's about as easy as it can get. There's no waiting in lines. There's no calling doors. Yeah,
no camping out. You just, you know, flip on your iPhone and it's there. It's sometimes free too. So just
depending on the screw up, you know, depending
on how bad we mess things up, it may just show up free.
Still working the billing system.
Nick, go ahead.
All right, I'm Nick from Breaking Bourbon, one of the three guys behind Breaking Bourbon, breakingbourbon.com. Check us out, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at Breaking Bourbon. And hey, glad to be here. I'm kind of back and forth between myself and Jordan. And I think over the past weekend, we convinced Eric to start joining in a little bit more too. So you'll see the man behind the man, I think, a little bit more here this year.
Ooh.
Uh-oh.
A secret so, coming glad alive. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Coming off the bench.
I like it.
Yeah, and so Nick, one thing that I noticed in your background was you all did a New Riff pick recently that went through Sealbox. You had a pretty funny sticker behind it. I also want you to kind of talk about that one.
Yeah. So these are some of the picks here. It's actually still waiting on my bottles, but it's just a test sticker on there. If you can see that, so we kind of wanted to play with the riff thing. So Riffler's mom. Stifler, you know, so Steve Stifler, so everybody that can relate to that. Interestingly, just had a 20-year reunion, so that movie actually came out. American Pie came out during the summer after graduation of high school and before college. So, needless to say, it was a fun summer. as soon as that kind of came up and we started batting around the idea, I think it just stuck, and that's what we went with. So,
how many more riff ideas are there going to be out there? We've got to be getting close.
I've had more inquiries about Riffler's mom, though. People have seen the sticker and it's like, hey, so how do I get one of those? Like, well, you got to be the number one Patreon supporter, I guess. So over to Breaking Bourbon.
They are sold out, though, now, too. I think, right, Blake? I think they sold out today through the Patreon supporters. But
yeah, it didn't take long.
No. No,
although I've seen Ken Riffey Jr., I've seen Riff James. so we got a few more riff puns, I think, still available. But
Riffomania. Yeah, there's so many out there. There's a lot of good ones, too. All right. And so to our resident lawyer, Brian, how's it going?
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me again. Great to be here. This is Brian with Sippin' Corn. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram now finally, and Facebook at Sippin' Corn, and online at sippincorn.com or bourbonjustice.com. And again, thanks for having me. Looking forward to this one.
So before we dive into it, Brian, did I see something that was posted by Brett Atlas a little bit earlier today? I guess there was a paper or something that was published that you had done recently that he finally said, at least he put it on his Facebook. For anybody that doesn't know, Brett Atlas, he's a friend of the show. He was on talking about Four Roses and barrel picks and stuff like that. But he said that he was quoted in one of your, I don't want to say like dissertation, I don't know what you call it, but you know, whatever it is.
Well, yeah, it's close to that. It's basically the scholarly journal side of what lawyers do. And I had an article published in a law journal from University of Kentucky, and for the bourbon history, and to make a point about how much bourbon enthusiasts dive deep into these issues, I quoted some of his articles from Bourbon and Banter. I had a breaking bourbon citation on there. I had Bourbon Truth on there, so I was trying to make a few points about how deep we all dive and how into the weeds we get, and those definitely provided some of the best examples for it.
All right. So Ryan, me and you need to step up our game and just not like bullshitting about stuff, but put some facts out there.
That's right. Facts are optional. I can understand why you would leave us out. I wouldn't want to be cross-checked or referenced, you know, for my facts.
But I appreciate being on there, Brian. That was the 2-year storage experiment. And that was definitely our longest dive into anything.
Oh, it was a great deep dive. You know, the oxidation effects. I mean, that was fantastic. Yeah, I tried to find a quote from the round table and I just couldn't find anything with factual support. So
the only factual support was actually the stuff that you contributed to. Is that what it is?
I don't want to cite myself. So.
I'm gonna quote myself from a recent podcast.
Although I did have a plug for the book in the article, so I can't say I didn't quote myself. But
You should.
Yeah, so I'll for anybody that's curious about what that is, I'll make sure I put it in the show notes of the podcast so you can go and check that out at your own leisure, because it is a long, long thing to read. I scrolled through like the first two pages and I was like, am I almost done? Oh crap, there's like 18 more to go. So yeah. I'll put that out there for anybody else that wants to see it.
Yeah, it's the insomnia cure. It is. Maybe just go to the parts where I quote the fellow bloggers and then be done. That's fine.
Perfect.
Ooh, I know Kenny battles insomnia, so there you go, Kenny.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. Let's see how much I can drink tonight. We'll see if we go to sleep later.
There you go.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and let's move on to our first topic conversation tonight. And this one is really focused around it was the big news last week. And this was the Jim Beam warehouse fire. It's estimated somewhere around like 45,000 barrels may have been lost at the Jim Beam warehouse fire. And this is just down the road of Castle and Key in the Glens Creek Distillery near Millsville, Kentucky. And if you put this into perspective, it's about half of the 92,000 barrels that were lost during the Heaven Hill Distillery fire of 96. And that's when 7 rick houses had actually burned to the ground. And at that time, that loss represented about 2% of the nation's bourbon supply at that time. And I think we can all kind of look at it and really say that this is a big travesty, right? This is a tragedy for all that involved. There were people that were commenting and saying things like, oh, it's only a white label, who cares? Or saying, oh, I have pre-fire OGD 114 and I'll go ahead and post it for sale. Or people were joking and saying, that's Jack Daniels starting the fire, or saying how Alcoholics Anonymous benefited from it. I mean, let's take a step back and think about it. Like, is this really like the current state of affairs of what we see in the bourbon community and what we should expect when something like this happens, when there's millions and millions of dollars on the line for a very large organization? There are firefighters that are sitting there trying to contain the fire, that are trying not to spread to people's homes in the area. And people are just making jokes at them. I mean, is this natural? Like, is this what we could expect from here on out?
I think one thing to point out is that no one got injured or died or anything in it, which is the key thing. I think the mood could have been very different if that was the case. And that scene right up front, that was the message that was out there. And I think because of that, you know, the tone was able to be different, or, you know, people maybe felt they could, you know, be different with the tone as a result of that. And that's really probably the biggest thing, is that, you know, you have these what could be really pretty scary incidents, happening, that, you know, fortunately we haven't had, you know, anything really seriously happen to anyone to get injured or killed, you know, more recently in some of these more major, highly publicized ones. So I think that plays into it in this case as well.
Yeah, it's kind of been a black eye for bourbon warehouses the past 2 years. I mean, it's like, how many more can, like, you know, get some natural disaster or something collapse? It's like, it just kind of makes you realize that, like, how old this stuff is. And, like, I don't know, it kind of needs probably some intervention maybe to kind of protect them more, like, not just like, oh, it's been there, it's been built forever, it's all good, you know? So, yeah, it's just been happening too much lately, I think. And it's kind of serious because we all go on barrel picks and we're all in those things, and tons of tourists go in and out of them. I'm really just, you know, it's just kind of scary, you know, that all this has happened so much recently. So I think people need to take it more seriously than just, oh, it's a white label, or it's, don't drink the water that's going in the, you know, in the Ohio River. Don't drink it. You know, it's definitely more serious than that. So it's something we need to, the community needs to take serious, and, you know, the distilleries as well.
Yeah, I think that's there's a few comments in the chat saying, you know, is this a Rick House problem of late? Like, is it the age that's catching up on these things? You know, on the Barton side, that most certainly could have been a problem, because there was maybe lack of oversight in regards of maintenance or something like that. However, this what happened at Jim Beam was a lightning strike. And from what I understand is that lightning poles are they're pretty ubiquitous anywhere. So they're stationed around the properties, and that's what's supposed to basically detract the lightning to go away from most of the warehouses. They're installed in a lot of places. However, you know, it's lightning. So by regards to lightning, hopefully it doesn't strike twice in the right spot or the same
spot.
Well,
sure, but the old warehouses are grandfathered. They don't have sufficient sprinkler systems like the new ones. If you have a... if your rick is so many barrels, you're not required to have them. It's like, okay, you know, these are like serious things that people can get hurt. And I think they need to take it seriously. That's just not some warehouse out there. I don't know.
Yeah. And this used to happen a lot more historically. I mean, there were fire, I don't know about the collapses, but there were definitely fires and there were all kinds of injuries in warehouses and at distilleries generally. So I think we're probably looking at it in the context of the big bourbon boom lately. So more people are paying attention to it. I mean, if this happened 10 years ago, it'd probably barely be a blip. But sure, fires happen. And I think what we might see is a change to have the ground built up around them to contain any spirits that get out, because we've got a fish kill on the Kentucky River now. I mean, it's a real ecological problem when this happens. So I expect to see some of this grandfathering kind of get questioned, and some of these warehouses might need to be brought up to more current code.
Yeah, I think the cynicism is kind of natural in anything like this. You know, you think just about anything serious that happens, there's going to be somebody, and a lot of us take this as a hobby, so it's only natural to joke about it when, you know, in real life, there's people whose livelihoods and all that kind of depend on it, which, you know, you look at this, and while Beam's a massive corporation, this is probably still a $40 million plus loss, so that is a big thing that should be taken serious. I know David from Rare Bird was saying, I think it was on Twitter or somewhere, just like, this is just what happens with something like this. You're just going to have the people joking around about it. And it's unfortunate to an extent, but at some point it's like, you know, what else we can't just sit here and mourn the loss of barrels as well. You know, as long as nobody got hurt. I don't know, I'm not going to be posting a bunch of pre-fire Jim Beam jokes, but at the same time, we didn't delete them from the Bourboner group either. I didn't feel like it was that offensive, I guess. Heard a whole lot more offensive stuff than warehouse jokes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Last
month, so. Yeah, I agree with that. I don't know. I just kind of took it in stride. It's going to happen. Any kind of news is going to get turned into a meme these days, and that's not the bourbon world. That's anything. You know, very serious issues happen, and somehow it becomes like a funny picture with some words on it.
And that's, well, and sometimes you need comic relief for serious what, you know, to kind of help you move past it or whatever.
It does seem like it's been happening a lot, and maybe that's just because we're focusing on a lot more now. You know, it's interesting to hear Brian say that this was very was much more prevalent, you know, a long time ago, you know, I guess maybe 30, 40, 50 years ago. But you would think we'd have a little more safeguards in place to stop some of the stuff, especially like the collapses. You know, you think building codes and everything would, and inspections would improve that kind of stuff. But lightning strike, that's pretty, you can't really avoid that unless you just have fire sprinkler systems and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And Blake, you kind of reminded me of something of like, you know, you did too, Ryan, of saying like you have to make light of a certain situation, you know, and I don't know like when the too soon thing really, you know, is supposed to like play a part into this. But, you know, it reminds me of like one of my favorite comedians is Daniel Tosh. And he says that like nothing is off limits. And it's kind of funny. It's like I think about it now, think back. I was like, yeah, well, maybe when is that boundary or that, you know, whenever can you say something about it? And I guess in this light, you look at it and you say, well, at this point, it is a financial loss. There was nobody that was hurt. There were people that put their lives on the line, but it wasn't to the point where, you know, it's not like any of us had like a barrel in there that was like our thing and we're like running in there to go save it, right? It was just like, it was a contained fire. They let it burn. I think I read a news article on WHAS or something like that. They were talking to one of the fire marshals, and they're like, yeah, this is the best smelling fire we've ever been to. You know, it's like one of those things that even the fire marshals are kind of having a good time with it. You know, I think it might just be in poor taste sometimes if it's like 30 minutes
when the day,
like, hey, I was going to use a pun of like, let's let the fire settle or dust settle first. Not my intention, but you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, give it a little bit of time, make sure everyone's okay. And then it's like, okay.
It's been a few days, Blake. You're clear.
I'm good. Okay. I feel you're better.
I mean, I've heard estimates as it was like $270 million of losses.
That seems like a lot for 45,000 barrels.
Well, I mean, you got to think 5,000 a barrel, you know, probably. I mean, it's cheap stuff that they're getting like probably 250 plus bottles out of. I mean, and then you times about 40,000. So I don't know.
I was thinking replacement cost.
Yeah, so you got to wonder what they insured it for.
Cost them $250 a barrel. Then they've got to rebuild the warehouse.
Right.
But yeah, and I could be way off.
And one of the worst opportunity costs too. So you're just, it just surprises you that they don't take, I guess they do have them insured, but you know, it seems like, okay, I could spend 500 grand on a warehouse to get it sprinklered or whatever, you know, correctly to help save. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe I'm just way off. I'll ask Donald Bezik or Donald Blinko.
Part of what's tragic to me though, is this, and people keep calling it the Beam fire, which of course it is, but it's Old Crow. And I don't know when these, I didn't pay attention when these were built, but this is a distillery built in the 1870s. I think is when Old Crow was built. I don't know if those date back that long, but if ever we were going to have a revitalization of the Old Crow brand, and if they were ever going to bring that distillery back as some kind of tour destination like they have at Old Taylor for Castle and Key, I mean, we're losing out on those opportunities, and that's what bums me out the most, since there wasn't any injuries about this.
Brian, I think you bring up a good point too, because I know Fred, who couldn't be on tonight, he kind of made a mention to me in a text message and saying like, this is scary. You know, not, it was when it was happening, is like, not just for the fire and everything. He's like, he's talking about the visitors, like the people of Bourbon, and really what this could mean, saying that this should, if more of these things happen, whether they're fires, whether they're warehouse collapses, any sort of distillery mishap that makes headlines, he said, this could completely change any visitor experience you ever go to. It could completely change any barrel pick experience you ever go on. Like, it could eventually get to the day where they're saying like, no, like, we're not allowing anybody else in the warehouses. Like,
forget a hard hat tour or anything like that.
Well, I mean, Kenny and I experienced that for a Barton pick, 1792 pick. And, you know, there was lightning in the area and they're like, no way, we're going to do it inside. And it's not as fun, you know, being in a little tasting room, but luckily the skies cleared and they let us go back in there. But yeah, it's he's totally right.
And that's for the right reasons though, too.
Oh, sure. Because absolutely.
It is legitimately.
Well, it's legitimate, but I always think when I think of a sterile experience, I think of the Heaven Hill downtown. I mean, it's like Disneyland, and you don't get any sort of real experience there. And that's could be what this turns into if the insurance companies won't insure the distilleries if they let people in. I mean, that's who's going to drive it. It's, can you get coverage or can you get coverage that you can afford? And maybe you have to limit it to visitor centers and kind of the Disneyland look.
Yeah.
Right. That would be a detriment. That would be a sad thing to see happen.
Yep.
But I would play this angle though, too. You know, I got sent the link and that from a lot of people who are outside of Bourbon who just know that I'm into Bourbon. And so they sent the link, but from somebody's perspective, that's not really involved in Bourbon, you know, you're so bombarded with bad things happening all the time. You know, do you look at something like this and not really think anything of it, you know, cause you're not involved. No one was injured or hurt. You know, you see bad, some much worse stuff than this happen on a daily basis in the news, depending on what you watch, you know? So in the big scheme of things, the impact is really a lot more just on, you know, the enthusiast and that specific kind of bourbon crowd, or the potential impact is there, you know, in addition to the environmental stuff, you know, but again, that gets to kind of just all those bad things just cycling through the news on a daily basis.
No, you're totally right. And who knows if this might've been a, you know, a smaller craft distillery who knows if would even made headlines, especially around the nation, just because of the size and the impact of what it was. I mean, you know, if I saw a quote from John Little from Smooth Ambler, he put on Facebook, and, you know, he said that it's sad to see these kind of incidents, like no matter the size of the company. And he says, I often put myself in Smooth Ambler's position, and a tragedy like this would be completely devastating to his type of business. So it definitely is a scale thing too, when it comes to it. So
yeah, they lose 45,000 barrels. They're done.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think at this point, I think we can kind of move on. We're all kind of fired up. Is it too soon?
Too soon.
Okay.
In the pour of pre-fire Heaven Hill.
All right. So so I won't do that. But yeah, now we're going to go into kind of the next topic. And this is the one that I think it's might have been a little bit old news by now, but we're going to go ahead and kind of spark the situation back up because it's the roundtable, and why not? Because this is going to be a lot of the opinions of really what we see of what's happening inside of the bourbon community and everything like that. So everybody kind of remembers about, oh gosh, what was it? About a year and a half ago. And this was something that we had talked about on the roundtable plenty of times. Nick had talked about it, saying, you know, every time I come down to Kentucky, what do? I grab a few bottles of Heaven Hill 6-year bottled and bond, and I take it back home with me. It's some of the best bourbon at $12 a 750 ml that you can get on the shelves. And a year and a half ago, they had announced that there was going to be the retirement or the phasing out of this particular product. When that announcement happened, shelves started clearing. I mean, gone in Kentucky, here and there and everywhere. It ended up getting to the point where I think now you can actually still get on the secondary market. It's somewhere around like $40 for a 750. So you get scarcity, people hoard it, people buy it up. This is what happens. And now, since they did discontinue a beloved $12 6-year product, and they Heaven Hill is now, I don't want to say relaunching, they are launching almost a similar product. It is their 7-year Heaven Hill bottled and bond. So with this comes a few different things. You get an additional year. It's still bottled and bond, so it's still 100 proof. However, it comes with a 233% price increase, about three times the price. So you're going from $12 to around $39.99 SRP. And with this, it also comes in its initial launch is also limited availability, only available in, like, I think 8 states across the US. So before we start diving into kind of like the business side, how do we compare this to other things in the market? But look at, I'm going to kind of pose it to you all, and Ryan, I'll kind of ask you first. Was this the right move by Heaven Hill?
You know, I love Heaven Hill, but man, they botch a lot of things, like the Elijah Craig 12-year age statement, like moving it to the back label, then moving it to the side, then doing it, and then saying, oh, it's not going away, and then it goes away, you know. And then this, it's like, I don't care what they do, just be upfront about it. Who cares, you know? Like, I'm still gonna love you, but I think, yeah, they should have just been like, hey guys, given the market, we have a great product, you know, there's stuff out there in the market that's way less age, not as good, you know, with a bigger price tag. We feel like this is what it's worth, and here you go. And I would have been like, yep, you're totally right. I totally agree with you. Give me my 7-year for $40. But, and I still will do that because it's going to be a great product. But yeah, it's just, I don't know why they do that. I just don't understand. But
I will say that I am wearing my Heaven Hill hat tonight to make sure that I am showing support for the brand because I still love the brand.
Oh, yeah, of course. I love their.
And yeah, I mean, it is. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's a dagger to the heart for a lot of bourbon consumers and bourbon lovers out there, because getting me wrong, like, this was on the shelves for a very, very long time around here. And it's not like it was flying off. No. It was a great value for what it was. But before we do that, you know, dive into more of it, Blake, kind of talk about your side. Do you think this was the right move by Heaven Hill to kind of get rid of it and relaunch it?
Yeah, I think it was definitely the right move. Not from, you know, my perspective as a consumer, but from a business standpoint, it was the best move they can make. You know, I can't imagine what the cost is on a, you know, 6-year-old bourbon, but the margins probably weren't huge. They've basically learned through all these other things of, you know, moving the 12-year to the back label, then pulling it off completely, then kind of redesigning the Elijah Craig barrel proof. And, they took away Elijah Craig 18-year and reintroduced it a couple of years later at four times the price, three times the price around there. They realize they can kind of do whatever they want. And, yes, a small group of us will kind of cry foul, but overall the market still embraces it and still buys it. And, it's just kind of keep doing what they want to do. And they know that the product was undervalued. So they said, okay, let's put it out at a higher price. People will still buy it. And it's still a pretty good deal. I have a different perspective on it because I'm not in Kentucky. So it's not something I could regularly get. So it's not like I'm missing out on anything. It's a plus to me because I'll actually now have a $30 to $40. What's the retail?
$40
bottle. But at that, I'm just going to go buy Elijah Craig, which is, slightly proofed down, but probably a little bit older. From a business standpoint, I think that's ultimately the right move. And we have given Heaven Hill more than enough reason to believe that the market will not care and they'll still go buy it. So,
yeah. The thing is, 90% of the market that probably didn't even realize that it was the Kentucky only 6-year product at $9.99 or whatever. So, it's like, who gives a shit about these bargain few that.
Mm-hmm. Now, that could turn on them really quickly if things start to get a little bit tighter and they need, the enthusiast market again. But I still think we're a little ways out on that happening. So I don't know. I mean, would I have loved to see another great value bourbon that's still really underpriced? Yes, of course. I think we'd all want to see that. But at the end of the day, it's a business and I'm guessing they made the right business move.
I just have one more point before you move on, Kenny, to the next person. I think the biggest travesty here is that, like you said, you'll go buy Elijah Craig for whatever or Henry McKenna, whatever. Well, they're going up too. So that's just the nature of the progression that's happening here. And so it's just going to slowly move on to those brands.
You look at it, Heaven Hill's had by far the most value-based bourbons for the longest time. You think of Henry McKenna 10 year, you think of Evan Williams single barrel, you think of Elijah Craig was 12 years for a while. Even Elijah Craig barrel proof, in my mind, is still a pretty good buy depending on where you are.
It's a great buy. It's a great buy.
J.W. Dant bottled in bond, like that is a great bottle for $20. So, while we want to kind of cast that first stone, it's kind of like there's still a lot of other great bourbon out there. So that's why it's like, hey, cash in, make your money, go build some more warehouses or something. So,
So Nick, I'll kind of ask you a question. Like, do you think the idea with this was to try and compete with other brands in the market, like the Woodfords and the Knob Creeks that are around that $40 price range?
Yeah. I think it's interesting thinking about before answer that question, thinking about the progression that it took, which was the undiscovered, nobody talked about it. It's sitting maybe dusty on the shelf for $12 in Kentucky. And then it kind of got discovered. And that's when you started to have people who were outside of Kentucky coming in like me. I was one of them. And I would buy a lot of it just because, quite frankly, the price was really the draw. And it was the value relative to the price. It was good for the price. And it's not like I stockpiled it. That's what I would take to a party and I would leave the bottle there. And then I'd get texts from whoever's house it was. There was a party saying, hey, I'm drinking this now. And I'd be like, fantastic. It's only available in Kentucky. Enjoy it. That kind of a thing. And then I think what happened was you started seeing more people clear the shelves because it kind of became obvious that maybe this wasn't going to go on forever. And it was such a good value. And so looking at the perspective from Heaven Hill, why sit there and let that happen? If the idea was it's kind of always available for people in Kentucky and it's suddenly kind of not available, or it looks like it's not going to be available, you're not really doing anyone any favor. So I agree. I think that was a smart move. Exactly how they went about doing it and why, I think that's kind of the next question that you're asking, Kenny, is, what is this product? What is it supposed to be? What's their goal with the product? I remember them talking about Elijah Craig and saying, well, we could have kept the 12 year on and just raise the price. But they said, we don't want it. We want a product that's accessible. We really want to keep the price about the same. How do we do that? We want to build a brand and have this really always on shelves. We don't want it to be Weller 12. We want it to be go to the store and you can buy it, you know, that type of thing. So now the question is this going to be their flagship brand? Do they want this available always, you know, to everybody? Do they want you comparing it to, like you said, a Woodford or something like that? I think that's yet to be determined. You know, I think they had to do something to it. You know, you're changing the price a lot. They added a year to it. It's kind of like, we can't just do the exact same thing. And then it looks a lot more, I think, what would be iconic or symbolic of where their branding and where everything is going, you know, where it does really come across is here's a representation of us. They push Bottled and Bond. I start to wonder if how much they push value versus we perceive value. That's kind of a curious point of mine, is where does that come from? Because it does step outside that boundary. And I think it does step outside that boundary of, well, everything's overwhelmingly high value. Now you're asking the question saying, well, this maybe isn't, you know, and you know, too, that the price might be the same for the next 10 years. And they know that, too, that you don't see a lot of these really creep up in price unless the retailers are doing. A lot of times they'll keep them the same. So I think that's yet to be determined where we're really going to see this and how it's going to be, you know, kind of viewed and consumed in the marketplace and where they want that, you know, the consumers to be.
Brian, I want to kind of let you kind of give your opinion. I mean, do you think this is competing within those different price points of the Woodfords and the Knob Creeks that are out there?
Hey, it's Kenny here, and I want to tell you about the Commonwealth's premier bourbon tasting and awards festival. It will be happening on August 24th in Frankfort, Kentucky. It's called Bourbon on the Banks. You get to enjoy bourbon, beer, and wine from regional and national distilleries while you stroll the banks along the scenic Kentucky River. There's also going to be food vendors from regional award-winning chefs. Plus, you get to meet the master distillers and brand ambassadors you've heard on the show. But the kicker is, Bourbon Pursuit, we're going to be there in our very own booth as well. Your $65 ticket includes everything, all food and beverage on Saturday. Plus, you can come on Friday for the free Bourbon Street on Broadway event. Don't wait. Go and buy your tickets now at bourbononthebanks.org.
Hey everyone, Ryan here, and I know when I celebrate a weekend with friends, I want to bring some of my best bourbon. However, if I'm on the car or a plane, it's not convenient, plus my bottles are clanging around, they're not really secure, so I have the perfect solution. The Aged in Ore Travel Decanter allows me to put 2/3 of my prized bottle in its unique tumbler. It's great for camping or really any outdoor activity. With the built-in 2-ounce pour lines, I know I'm giving my friends just the right amount of my special bourbon. Go learn more at pursuittraveldecanter.com to get yours today.
You've probably heard of finishing beer using whiskey barrels, but a Michigan distillery is doing the opposite. They're using beer barrels to finish their whiskey. New Holland Spirits claims to be the first distillery to stout a whiskey. The folks at Rack House Whiskey Club heard that claim and had to visit the banks of Lake Michigan to check it out. It all began when New Holland Brewing launched in 97. Their Dragon's Milk beer is America's number one selling bourbon barrel aged stout. In 2005, they applied their expertise from brewing and began distilling. A beer barrel finished whiskey began production in 2012, and Rackhouse Whiskey Club is featuring it in their next box. The barrels come from Tennessee, get filled with Dragon's Milk beer twice, then mature bourbon is finished in those very same barrels. Rackhouse Whiskey Club is a Whiskey of the Month club on a mission to uncover the best flavors and stories from craft distillers across the U.S. Along with 2 bottles of hard-to-find whiskey, Rackhouse's boxes are full of cool merchandise that they ship out every 2 months to members in over 40 states. Go to rackhousewhiskeyclub.com to check it out and try a bottle of beer barrel bourbon and beer barrel rye. Use code PURSUIT for $25 off your first box.
Brian, I want to kind of let you kind of give your opinion. I mean, do you think this is competing within those different price points of the Woodfords and the Knob Creeks that are out there?
Well, $40 is the new $25. Mm-hmm. And everything that we used to be able to get just 5 to 8 years ago now is going to be $40. So as consumers, we just have to accept that. What really struck me the most about this is a few days after this happened, I was at a continuing legal ed seminar and the KDA had a presenter there. And she was, and I'd heard this before, but totally forgot it. She was saying that 60% of a dollar for your spirits purchase in Kentucky goes to taxes. So you've got a $12 bottle, and you've got just over $7 of that goes to some way, shape, or form to taxes. Heaven Hill can't make. I mean, I'm sure they're doing fine, but
hold on. You
got to raise the price.
You forget the retail. Who makes money off the retail, and who makes money in the distributor, and then so you have what's left of the actual producer.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, I mean, it's you can't sell bourbon for $11.99. You just can't. I always treated the 6 year as sort of my bar. I mean, if you had a craft whiskey that was however old, and you couldn't be better than a 6 year Heaven Hill bottled and bond, it wasn't going to be worth spending $60 on it. When I could get at least in Kentucky a $12 bottle of fantastic bourbon. So I, as a consumer, I'm sad about it. As looking at it from Heaven Hill's perspective, it's a no-brainer. To Nick's point, I totally agree. This is so much better than if they had done the exact same product, exact same bottle, exact same label, cheap plastic, white screw top, and increased the price to $40. They couldn't do that. They had to do some premium, make some premium changes to it. And they've done that, you know, that with the cork and the label and everything else. So it's, people are going to buy it. It's going to be worth it, you know, air quotes worth it. But as a consumer, I'm sad about it, but it makes sense.
I just don't understand. Why can't they just be honest? Like, I just don't get what's the advantage of like, let's pull it off the market and we'll pretend like we just hit it and we're not going to do anything.
Hopefully in a year they forget about it.
People forget about it. And then
it's like,
going to buy
a present with your kid at Target and be like, okay, I'll go hide in the closet till Christmas.
I mean, I just want to go in these boardroom meetings and be like, are you serious? Like, do you think we're that stupid? Like consumers are that stupid. I guess it's my point that most of these distillers just don't care about consumers, but, anyways, I don't care. I totally understand why they're doing it. Yes, $12 a bottle. I mean, we sell bourbon. We can't sell. I couldn't even sell it for $90 a bottle and make money. So it's, I totally get it. Just don't fool us. We're not idiots. Like, it's stupid.
Was that the case though? Or was it just, you know, I guess looking at it, I'm not at all surprised. I mean, when it happened, I really kind of assumed this was coming. I was just not sure what it was going to be exactly. In all honesty, I'm surprised the price is as low as it is. I kind of thought they were going to go more the old Fitz route and have more of a premium thing and kind of step it up that much. So because it is more of the everyday price of what you're seeing now, like you said, the new 40s, the new 25, it actually had me a little excited of, hey, this is something hopefully I can go buy now. And it's a little bit older. I assume it's going to taste a little bit different than what the 6 year was. And I'm not really sure, you know, with all these discussions, they knew exactly what the plan was going to be or that they would want to say anything until it was coming. You know, do you want to say it a year before it's ready, you know, because they went from 6 to 7, you know, or was it, you know, they just thought the time would be the key, that they just thought, oh, after a year, people would forget. That's a good question.
I think they got mad Ezra Brooks won some awards at 7 years. And they're like, you know what? Screw this.
Well, I think wouldn't we all appreciate a press release at this point that just says, it's like, guys, we're going to make some more money. So you're all stupid and you're blindly buying anything on the shelf and anything with $100 price tag, your dumb uncle's definitely buying. So
y'all pay way too much attention to bourbon. Like just take a back seat on this one. It's okay.
Yeah.
I actually think there's a whole brand opportunity there, Blake, for just that brand that just jokes about everything.
It's called
it's bourbon legit. Truth, you know, bourbon. Like, yeah.
That would be incredible though. I would be like, I don't know. I think it would be so awesome if they did that, but instead they got to do this, you know, play behind the scenes ping pong match. I don't know. Stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Ryan, you're right. Like nobody that pays attention to stuff would ever forget, especially for a product that was iconic to, I wouldn't say a lot of us, but at least people that are well known or should I say really know the bourbon landscape very well. Like they know about the product. They know where to find it and they know about it. Now, the other side of this is perhaps it wasn't their favorite, right? It's a value budget bourbon. Like, that's what they loved about it. It wasn't necessarily say like, oh, this is my unicorn, right? It's not, that's what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be that this is a budget bourbon. But Ryan, you'd also mentioned the Ezra Brooks point of view. And I kind of want to look at the competing else side of the market, because anybody that, okay, I mean, we'll go ahead and say it, like Ezra Brooks Barrel Proof is basically contract distilled Heaven Hill, right? It's the same exact thing. And now, so we're looking at the difference of a barrel proof product from Heaven Hill at the 7 year age statement versus the Heaven Hill product, bottled and bond, less proof and the same price point. What gives?
What do you get? Yeah.
Like what gives? So that comes another point. Like, now who are they competing with? Are they competing against themselves?
Yeah.
No, there's no question. There's a high value though too with the Ezra. And I think that was recognized right away. You know, so part of that is that value proposition. You know, just thinking about when, you know, age always comes into play when you think value. And you know, you get this weird dichotomy with smaller craft distillers where stuff's coming out for higher prices, but then in some cases people are like, oh, it's craft, it's not kind of recognized yet. Unless you want to support them, it's in some cases it's not really there yet. You know, in other cases you have, you know, somebody like New Riff who's killing it, you know, with a 4 year, and you know, with bottled and bond, you know, so here you go. Is a 4 year, is a 7 year, you know, you look pricing. I mean, do you put them on the same platform for I'm gonna compare this to that? Or do you say, well, no, there's a different comparison here because of the distillery size and, you know, those kinds of things. So that's the questions you always have to, you know, kind of look at. And some of it comes down to just how much you like it, how good it tastes, but it also comes down to how they're speaking with you. And I think, Ryan, you made a good point, you know, for the enthusiast side, because maybe some other people, the general public doesn't care, but you never want to be lied to, and you never want to feel like the wool was pulled over your eyes, which unfortunately with the Elijah Craig age statement, that was how everybody felt, you know. And so I think, you know, lesson learned, avoid doing that. Like, think proactively to speak to that group so that you don't lose that, you know, that faith and that community that's behind the distillery.
All right, Nick, here's
Nick, what's that new Riff bottled and bond cost?
$55. Or no, the bottled and bond.
Bottled bond's what is it, Blake? 40?
40. Yeah.
40.
So right there. 4 year. Yeah. 40. And I think a great value. I think it's a great product.
So I
guess this caps the secondary price of the 6 year bottled and bond, right? It's got to be under 40.
Well, now it's the old label though. They changed it. So now it's, you know, it's
discontinued.
So it's opposed in a way, right? So you've got a label you can't buy on the shelf anymore.
Yeah.
I want to throw another one out. Sorry, Ryan. I want to throw another one out there. Oh, go ahead, Ryan.
Well, I'll say, here you go, Heaven Hill. I know you're going to do this within the next year or two. When you want to raise Henry McKenna's prices and you change the packaging and you change the cork so that you can justify a $20 increase, just say, we are going to change the cork and the label, and we're going to raise it by $20 because we think it's undervalued. And I will say, amen, I will go buy it still.
I think that's a good ad. Ryan, that's it, though. Like, anyone who's paying attention is somebody who cares. Anyone who's not paying attention doesn't care. So you got to speak to that group.
Yep. I mean, that was, Ryan, you kind of teed up the next question right there is we now see an aspect with inside of Heaven Hill that they're kind of cannibalizing themselves, where they have products that have higher age statements and higher, I don't want to say perceived value, and sometimes even higher proof, selling for less money than this product that they're putting out. So, you know, you look at the Henry McKenna bottle of bond, as you mentioned, you got Evan Williams, you got JTS Brown, you've got JW Dant, you have all of these different products. And mind you that unless something's changed, and I don't know recently, but their bourbon, not weeded mash bill, but their regular bourbon mash bill is one bourbon mash bill. Like, nothing's changed. So it's the same product that's going into all these, just different aging warehouses, locations, so on and so forth. So do you all see themselves as kind of like cannibalizing and like making themselves like they're fighting against themselves in the market with their own products?
In a way, maybe. I think fewer people are going to tie those things together than, you know, when you think of the mass market. I'm not sure a lot of people walk in and realize they're coming from the same place at the store. So I think it's still a pretty small percentage that it even acknowledges that.
It's like, why do you have a CVS on, you know, two blocks away from each other? And it's like, well, you're more likely to stop in at the CVS or Walgreens if it's, you know, right next to you as opposed to 2 miles away. It's still not that big of a deal. So if you go into a store and it's like, all right, what's on the shelf? If, you know, they only had one product, you're less likely to grab that bottle when there's 100 products on the shelf. So they put 8 to 10 out there, you're more likely to grab it. So
I think the answer to your question, Kenny, when I was out at a bourbon event at a different city and I'd met some people that just started drinking bourbon 6 months ago, they had no idea that Eagle Rare, Buffalo Trace, and all, you know, under that same mash bill were the same exact mash bill. And they're like, what? You're kidding me. Like, it's the same mash bill. They have no idea that, like, all these brands are the same mash bill, just different prices, different age, whatever. So they just, like, the everyday consumer has no idea.
And you pointed them to the bourbon or mash bill breakdowns.
I actually didn't use that as a cheat sheet. I did use that as a cheat sheet. Thank you.
There you go.
We give away posters of that shit now.
Yeah. Thanks for coming. Here's your mash bill.
Yep. Yeah. But I do want to also give a shout out to Dave over at Rarebird 101, because I know he's been talking a lot in the chat here. Is always saying, like, Wild Turkey 101, it's still there. Price hasn't changed. So you can always go there.
I saw his $10 comment on that. It's the new $10, right?
Exactly. So he's trying to put his stake in the ground and hoping
that with bourbon of choice.
Yeah, well, he's also hoping the Campari folks don't start taking a note out of Heaven Hill's playbook here. But then the also kind of thing is, you know, when we look at this and we look up from the enthusiast point of view, you know, we are the bourbon enthusiast. This is, if you're listening to this podcast, you are a bourbon enthusiast. Yeah. There's no way getting around it, right? You are one of the few people that really care. Maybe not as much as us, but you care a lot. You care a lot.
A niche of a niche.
Exactly. And so you kind of look at it and you're like, well, if Heaven Hill really wants to make money off the enthusiasts and really care about them, this is what David at Rarebird 101 said. He says, maybe you should sell single barrels at more than 94 proof, right? Do something more than just what you can do at Elijah Craig. And I think he might be onto something here.
Yes, they ruined those single barrel picks by selling them at 94 proof. It's a travesty, really. Mm-hmm. But, you know.
And so the last kind of thing I want to hit on with this, as it's kind of rounding out this topic here, is we had noticed inside of the press release, and this is almost like unheard of, to be able to have a bourbon that's being launched coming from a prestigious distillery inside of Kentucky. And it says it's available in 8 states. And you start looking down, you start looking, and there's one abbreviation you don't see. And that's KY. You do not see KY as one of the first states that are out there. Now, Ryan and I have a kind of a good inkling of why this might be. And I'll kind of let Ryan take it here. So Ryan, kind of give your thought and your process of why wouldn't you go and make Kentucky an available market on day one?
Because they know they'll sell it no matter what, whenever it gets here. So they got to go spread to the masses and get the new consumers, which I understand, you know, it's totally cool, but it's like Fred always talks about, you can't forget the people that brought you to the dance. You know, it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's frustrating, but you know, that's totally why, but
it's just great to see, you know, KY not get something that the rest of us do. I just think we can all agree that it's about time. So,
and New York is on that list. So that means 3 to 6 months after it's released, we'll see it actually in stores.
It's like, you know, Florida, all the fun releases are going to come after everyone's Instagram has been flooded with pictures of these new releases nonstop. But hey, I'm excited.
Yeah, I mean, Ryan and I, we were talking about this because he recently took a trip, and it's kind of like Kentucky is very, very small in the big picture of things. You know,
that was gonna be my next point. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, saying that, you know, yes, there's 4 million plus barrels of whiskey aging in Kentucky. That's more than the population of Kentucky. Guess what? That's about half the size of Dallas.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like there's.
And then you got cities like Houston and LA and New York that are, you know, just it'd be even bigger. It's like, yeah.
Yeah. So even when you look at per capita buying, which I'm sure is higher here, you're still not touching, not even close to the bigger markets.
Yeah. Cause I think California and Texas, obviously, cause they have the biggest population, but, you know, I mean, they're just crushing Kentucky as far as, you know, consuming power and booze.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to change it one bottle at a time.
You know, that'll be interesting just kind of going back to these brands are realizing they don't need the enthusiast nearly as much as kind of as they hope initially. Or as we hope. You know, what starts happening when this stuff stops hitting Kentucky as much? Because overall, Kentucky still gets the lion's share of a lot of the allocated bourbon. And to my knowledge, this is the first one that kind of gave the Kentucky snub. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, you know, if that's kind of hurts the brand overall, or they just find a new market and never look back. So it'll be interesting.
No, I think you're totally right. I think this is going to be, it could be one of those pivotal moves we start seeing in regards to the market and how things shift. And when somebody is going to launch a product, where are they going to launch it? And they're going to look at the target markets. They're going to look at where do the most bourbon consumers live? Now, granted, Kentucky is there, but Kentucky's also a large state. Kentucky isn't the size of Houston, right? Like Houston's a pretty big populace. Actually, it's a much bigger populace than Kentucky as a state, right? So yeah, that might be the idea of like, maybe that's where you go. Like that's where the money is. And not only that is this is not a game of, you know, trying to target a particular kind of consumer. Like this is a game of people with disposable income that are buying.
Yeah. I mean, Kentucky's a poor state. I mean, they're one of the, you know, probably top 10 poorest states in the, if not even higher than in the country. So, I mean, there's not a lot of people with disposable incomes that can just drop money on expensive bourbons all the time.
But we spend it on rep tickets and bourbon.
And that's right.
Priorities.
But was that the thinking though? Or, I mean, does something play into it? And because it is really odd that it was a Kentucky only release and kind of coming back, you know, you'd think like that's the narrative that it was Kentucky only and we're going to start in Kentucky. So, you know, was it because they wanted more momentum in other states first, or, you know, was there concern that it was going to be received or perceived really negatively because, you know, you took it away and then brought it back at the price it's coming back at? You know, you got to wonder if there's more to it than just this is what's going to give the most momentum, as much as, you know, was there a PR play that got batted back and forth about where do we start here? Because it seems like it's going to be everywhere. And it seems like wherever it is, it's new, it's talked about, it's probably going to do pretty well. So it is really odd that it didn't start in Kentucky. I got to admit that, despite thinking it's a smart move, not being in Kentucky is really, it makes me wonder how they came to that conclusion.
Well, I mean, it could be like, oh, well, it's been in your state for the past how many of your years?
You haven't been buying it.
You didn't care about it until a year and a half ago. Yeah. Like, let's go somewhere else. You know, it could be that.
You didn't care until we said we were going to pull it, and then it got popular.
Yep.
I don't know.
Absolutely. So let's go ahead and let's kind of finish this one on a fun little touchy subject too, because why not, right? So this was a question that kind of came in over Twitter, and it was kind of in regards of secondary market pricing in retailers and how do you justify buying stuff. And so Kurt Belawoski said, how do you support retailers that are struggling to elevate prices in regards of allocated or limited and hard to find bottles? He said, I live in Western South Dakota and they hardly get any. Exactly. Literally, you just took the words out of my mouth. He said, we hardly get any allocated bottles of good bourbon. However, I went to the store the other night where I saw an Elmer T. Leaf on the shelf for $60. If I had not already had two bottles at home, I probably would have bought it. However, the first bottles that I did buy were $35 each. I ended up buying store picks at the retailer the other night instead, and they're delicious, but I just couldn't pull the trigger on the Elmers, especially at that inflated price. He said, what do you think? I figured, is any business I give them better than none? But it just kind of leaves a bad taste in my mouth about their business. So I guess I'll kind of hand it over to you all. Is there a reason, or is there a time that you should support these retailers that are, and this is kind of even going to, this is actually a recent thing. We've had Jamie Ferris from Lincoln Road on the podcast before. He just recently released his Willett Family Estate bottles. He had a 17-year barrel that he had, as well as I think an 11 and a 5-year, but the 17-year he was selling for $1,000 a bottle. So everybody knows Lincoln Road. Everybody loves him. However, should you support businesses like this, and why or why not?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess I'll jump straight into it. But I mean, to me, if it's selling for that, you know, that price point on the secondary market, why shouldn't the retailer take advantage of that? Now, granted, you could say that he could offer it to other retailers or other customers who are frequently buying, but the whole market in general right now is pretty underpriced. And, you know, even with the Lincoln Roads, was there a single bottle that went unsold in the first, I don't know, 48 hours? I'm pretty sure they're all gone. So
probably not, man.
Yeah. So that's where the market drove it. And it just, at this point, seems a little naive to think that, you know, why would Jamie sit there and sell it for $300 when he knows some guy's going to buy it and put it for $1,000 on, yeah, you know, the bourbon secondary market?
He's in the
market.
Parking lot and he's already got it posted.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I imagine that's the most frustrating thing ever. And you kind of got to find a balance. While I think some of these guys, you're finding the balance and they have these, you know, trophy bottles that are just going to sit on the shelf. You know, it's a you know, quote unquote, Pappy 10 year for $4,000 or something. It's like, okay, you obviously don't understand what's actually going on. But for guys who are really into bourbon, they know the market. Like, I don't have a problem with them, you know, being the ones to get the good margins from this, you know, better than the guy just sitting in his car, taking a crotch shot and throwing it on a Facebook group. So,
I mean, is the perception changing? And all us, you know, Brian or Nick, like, what do you think? Is the perception changing over time that, you know, if we rewind the clocks back 2 or 3 years ago, we're like, oh, you know, screw these retailers. Like, they should be selling it at, you know, retail price. Like, they keep doing this. But now we're kind of like, hey, like, you know, you got to will it. It's undervalued. You got Pappy. It's undervalued. You got BTAC. It's undervalued. Like, you should be charging secondary market prices. Like, what do you think?
Yeah, I was really frustrated 5 years ago when I would go to a store and I would see it's something that, you know, wasn't BTAC, wasn't a Pappy 23. It, you know, it'd be something like an Elijah Craig 12-year barrel proof. I remember at a store outside of Lebanon was charging something like $200 for it 5 years ago. And that's just outrageous. And there's another store just outside of Lawrenceburg that charges jacked up prices. And now you look back at that and you wonder, well, you know, it's who's in, you know, air quotes again, entitled to that money. So I don't necessarily blame a retailer for charging that. I mean, it's not, people use the word gouging. It's really not gouging. It's what the market bears. And it's similar to our Heaven Hill discussion. As a consumer, I can't stand it. I hate it. You know, I want the value. I want to be able to get my $55 Elijah Craig barrel proof. I want to be able to get my 6-year Heaven Hill bottle and bond for $12, but I can't do it anymore. And then I think the other thing we need to think about is reliability. There's been enough problems on the secondary market about who you can trust and who you can't trust. And you should be able to trust a store more. I mean, I know a lot of people talk about bar pourers and you can't trust an open bottle, but if you're buying a sealed bottle from a store, at least you know you should be getting what the bottle is.
Yeah.
So from that standpoint, I don't blame them for charging that. That doesn't mean I'm going to buy it. Someone will buy it, but I won't. But I don't blame them.
Yeah, I think there's a difference in seeing like a $500 Weller 12 and a $2,000 or $2,500 Pappy 23. Like, you know, they're one of the things is not like the other, where I can kind of say, yeah, you'll probably get somebody to walk in who buys the Pappy, but the Weller 12, that's just a dumb buy no matter who you are. So
yeah, yeah. The Weller Special Reserve that's confused with the Weller 12.
Yeah. I mean, send those guys to me.
I wrote something about this. I was just looking, it was almost 3 years ago now. And I used the word gouging in there, and I know now, and I know at the time, it's not technically gouging. It was the point of the context of the write-up, just the case for MSRP. But this was, and even 3 years ago, I feel like it was very different than it is right now. I do think it's come to be more accepted where I think maybe over the past 5, 6, 7 years, you can get back to a point where, not to say it wasn't happening at all, but it was much less frequent. And you certainly still had a lot of opportunity for MSRP, and you had a lot of retailers that didn't realize what they had yet. And now you've really seen, I think, two directions. I think one, they're getting more educated about what is what, but you do have those that are putting the stupid price on something, thinking it's something else, not knowing, you know, and it is a little frustrating in some cases. The flip side is, you know, go where they have the things that you want, go where they treat you good, and don't go to the other places. And, you know, retailers can still be creative. You know, there's a local retailer here that's a little bit off the beaten path, had the best selection, you know, pretty much in the area, and decided this year is going to sell all his allocation at MSRP, basically, but you're going to get basically a ticket to buy it by buying a bottle. So he cleared out a bunch of great stuff on his shelves for the most part at MSRP, and then sold the stuff for basically MSRP. So he actually did pretty well with that, and he generated a lot of goodwill with the community too, because it was a fun thing that he did. You know, so I still think there's opportunity there, but it's where you want to position as a retailer, your store. You know, and you're seeing retailers online, you know, if you want to have a wide selection, you can't put everything on at MSRP because it's going to be gone and you don't have a selection. It's the same thing with bars. The Pappy is gone if you're doing it for $15 a port. You've got to price it high enough that you have enough. It lasts until your next allocation. That's the way they're thinking. So depends on where the retailer is going to, you know. And so what do you do in that position? Yeah, if you're a retailer, you're looking at that and saying, why should somebody go sell it somewhere else illegally when I'm the one who's, you know, taking all the risk, putting all the money out? And really, it's pretty small percentage of what they're doing anyway, you know, where you have that opportunity to make a few $1,000 pretty easily. Kind of hard to blame them for doing that, you know? So it's just, it's frustrating to see though, because it does pull this stuff that was within reach before a little bit further out of reach, and further out of reach for a lot of people too.
Yeah. You make a good point. Like this small percentage of what they do. I mean, these liquor stores, I mean, they make profit off these limited releases, but it doesn't pay the bills for them. You know, it's a nice thing to do, but they could care less. I mean, not care less, but it's just something nice that they can offer their premium customers. And so, yes, is it frustrating? The annoying thing is like the Wellers and like the Elmer Tees that you're like, seriously, like I get the Pappies and like Willets being, but like the everyday that were like $30 a bottle, like why is it $120, $200 a bottle? That's just stupid. But anywho, I don't even know where I'm going with this.
What's happened on the secondary when, for example, Drew started charging higher prices at the gift shop?
Yeah, they just went up. I mean,
basically, a flipper just doubles whatever the retailer is. Like that's how it works.
And people still pay it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, maybe there are certain brands that just fall into this umbrella, right? That are the, I don't know, like the untouchables, right? Maybe Willett's one of those brands that just says like, hey, it doesn't matter whatever it is, like you're gonna sell whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I still wonder about the percentage that really are actually buying on secondary and how much of that percentage is outside a restaurant or bar who's the ultimate purchaser, who's actually still gonna have a markup even at a secondary price in a lot of cases. You know, I see friends go to local stores and buy stuff that's way overpriced. You know, they're not at all even involved in the secondary. You know, so I think that's just becoming more prevalent now. And I think that's probably a much larger percentage of the higher priced purchases is they are happening at retail now. And in a way, that's where they should be happening. You know, it's ultimately what makes sense. But part of it's uneducated consumers. Part of it's just that demand. And part of it's, in some cases, it's $150. It's not the end of the world for some people. You know, so if they overpay for it, they're happy because they got something they really wanted. And it is what it is.
Yep. All right. I know we can talk about retail and pricing and secondary and all this kind of stuff for, I think, probably for another roundtable, maybe another hour. Who knows? We might stick around afterwards and talk about it some more. But I think that's a good way to kind of cap this and end this because, you know, for a lot of us as hardcore bourbon consumers, we've given out the tips. I know that you all with blogs, like there's tips on how to be a good bourbon consumer, you know, shop at the same store, making sure that you're buying at the right place and
how to manner.
And well, I mean, you really like you establish a relationship and that's really what it's about. You know, don't sit there and, you know, cause the end of the day, you know, some of the big box chains, they might not take care of you. You're going to be in the, I don't know what you would call it, but basically the rat race with everybody else trying to get these allocated bottles, and you're paying whatever thousands of dollars to get your names on these lists. And it's tough. It is a pay to play kind of game. And at the end of the day, maybe if you're spending all this money, getting all this other kind of stuff, maybe you should just be buying them a secondary anyway. So, but like I said, we'll save that for another topic on another night. But, you know, gentlemen, I want to say thank you again for joining us on tonight's roundtable. It was a good discussion talking about the, you know, the Jim Beam stuff, the Heaven Hill stuff, and then as well as this. So as usual, I'm going to let you all kind of give a ability to give a shout out of where you all blog and where they can find you and everything like that. And we'll start off how we started. Blake, with you first.
All right. You know, always a good discussion. So glad to be here. Again, I'm Blake from bourboner.com. That's bourbonr.com, as well as sealbox.com, SEELBACHS.
Yep. And now before I realize it, one of the things that Kurt had asked, should I have bought those Elmer Tillys at $60? I would have said yes. I probably would have bought them at $60.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's, you know, you got to look at it like, even at $60, that bottle's probably better than the majority of stuff that is out there right now. So
what's the MSRP on that? 60 isn't really.
What's I think it's like 35, 30.
Yeah, 30, 35.
I think that varies a lot by state though, too, because I've seen some of the New York prices. They're quite a bit more. And I know retailers get hit with like a split case charge, and in some cases where they're paying an extra $3 a bottle or something, and they don't have a choice. It's this is what you're paying, you know, type of thing. So prices move around a lot. That's not too far off. I'm thinking more when you're paying $150 for Elmer. That's where
you don't do that. I mean, I don't want to be a jerk, but I haven't bought Elmer probably in 5 years since it's been $30. I mean, it's just not. It's good and all, and I've got some, so that's what makes me a jerk for saying I'm not going
to
buy it.
Yeah, but you have to camp here to get it, so it's like not worth it.
It's not worth it to camp. Yeah, do not camp for Elmer.
Yeah.
That's bring Elmer camping. That's what you do.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
There you go. Flip the script on it. Nick, go ahead and close it out for us. Or
all right. I'm Nick from Breaking Bourbon. Check us out on breakingbourbon.com and social media at Breaking Bourbon.
And I know that this guy isn't going to go camping for Elmer. So, Brian, go ahead.
All right. Thanks. Brian with Sippin' Corn, SIPPNCORN. You can find me mostly on Twitter, a little bit on Instagram and Facebook. And you can also find me on sippingcorn.com and bourbonjustice.com. Thanks, guys.
Speaking of Elmer, I think the last bottle I got was the granny panties one or whatever. It tastes like a basement. Like
I got one of those. I got one of those.
Oh, you got one of those bad ones?
Yeah, I got one.
I got one. And since then, I haven't opened any more. I'm a little nervous.
Yeah.
I think it's a throwback to a round table back in late 2015, maybe 2016, something like that.
Yeah.
And they basically just said, like, no, it's fine.
Yeah.
Right. People buy it. It's fine.
Mm-hmm. It fits our profile perfectly.
We're going for that mothball scent.
That's why laser codes are important, people.
There you go. You heard it from the man that if you need evidence, that's what it is.
That's right.
All right, so let's go ahead. We'll kind of round this out. You know, gentlemen, I want to say thank you again for coming on the show tonight, and everybody that was on the chat, thank you so much. There was a lot of good comments in there, and talking about you know, Wild Turkey, and talking about Heaven Hill, and kind of everybody that has a kind of a stake in this sort of game here. And it's good to see a lot of the comments really come through, because it really does show the passion that this community does have behind a lot of these brands and really what it does mean to it. And then Ryan, I'll let you close out here in a second, but people, make sure that if you do like the show, leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It's always great to kind of see that coming through. And we're always trying to make the show better every single time with good guesses as such as we've had on tonight.
All right. So I'm up.
Yeah, that's kind of how it works.
Yes. It's not like you've done this 200 or something.
I'm not the Cal Ripken, so it's great discussion. You know, it's as irritating as it is what, like, the way Heaven Hill has done this. I mean, it is pretty cool though. And like, it just shows you like how much potential bourbon still has to go. Every year I'm like, all right, it's maxed out. Like, we're going to hit, you know, it's, but now I'm kind of still thinking it's just the beginning. And it's just, you know, stuff like this just shows you that there's still some trajectory and a lot of growth, which is good for all of us, even consumers. And I think we're going to hit the glory period in about 5 years where we have tons of great bourbons, great values. But it's just cool to see. And I just hope they invite me on their next press conference, but on their next conference table board meeting where I can give them a little advice. But thanks for everyone that listened in tonight. We appreciate it. And the chat always, I've been following it all night. I love the chat. It's awesome. So anywho, thanks, Kenny. Wrap it up.
All right. Well, with that, cheers, everybody. And we'll see you all next week.
Cheers.